Welcome to Words That Matter, a modern day book club. I'm your host, Lee Smith. And this morning we have such a fun show. Someone I respect tremendously, someone I've known for a while, someone I've learned so much from, and he's just a terrific writer. He's the author of several other books, including Sandstorms and Translating Los Angeles. He is also our country's premier translator of Arabic literature. He's translated novels, perhaps most famously, by the Nobel Prize winning Egyptian novelist Naguib Mahfouz. He's a retired intelligence officer who left the CIA, one of our most highly decorated spies, and as he explains in his new book, In Obscura, Adventures in the World of Intelligence. He's also one of America's most glamorous spies, and his new book, In Obscura, is a beautiful, wonderful, exciting book. It's the story of a good man who was always in the most interesting place at the most important time. And that man is Peter Theroux. Peter, thank you so much for being here with us today on Words That Matter.
Good morning, Lee. How are you?
I'm doing very well. So look, Peter, I don't think there's anything like this in all of American literature. A book that covers both the world of American literature. There's a scene where you're sipping martinis with the irascible Gore Vidal. There's another scene where you're at a party having a great time, and it appears you're discreet as the intelligence officer you are, but you're very discreet. But it seems to me that you're describing a party with Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon, where you're celebrating, among other things, their famous movie Thelma and Louise. So you're at that party, and from that party, you go to Langley, Virginia, where you get a polygraph test to join the Central Intelligence Agency. So it's mind-blowing how you go from one world to another. If you can explain how you got there, how you got from Hollywood. You're a pillar of one of America's most famous literary families, including the novelist Paul and Alexander Theroux, and your nephew Justin, the screenwriter and actor. So you went from that world to the CIA. How did it happen?
Well, what happened, it was mind-blowingly scary, Lee, because I was writing for National Geographic. I was doing field work for them. I was living here in LA, and I spent a few visits with Gore Vidal at the Beverly Hills Hotel. I was interviewing him, but you know, he was a drinker, and we had that in common. I was wrapping up a career as a writer and translator and weighing the options. I had family reasons as well for maybe wanting to go back to the East Coast, like you. That's where I'm from. By the way, thank you for. I'm the best Arabic translator in the country. You just guaranteed I'll get beaten up in the parking lot at the next American Translators Association.
Oh, yeah. It's a rough crowd. It's a rough crowd, but the American translators.
Any interpreters don't even start. But the deal was that I was already in the paid service of the CIA because I was doing unclassified Arabic to English translation work for an outfit that, well, doesn't exist anymore or exists under a different name. It was called the Foreign Broadcast Information Service. It became the Open Source Center and various other things. So it was actually not a very big step to doing the polygraph, getting the full top secret clearance. And for family and personal reasons, I started working for the agency as a full-time employee, full-time analyst.
Okay, so for family reasons, what did your family say? Because you have an interesting background. Again, with all of the writers and famous people in your family, your family also has something of a CIA background too. So they're
my oldest brother, Eugene, was a case officer. You know, he was an operative. The word spy doesn't apply to everybody. We throw it around, but my oldest brother was a case officer in East Asia. Whereas I was a headquarters analyst and then a a field officer in various capacities in war zones. I was in Iraq, I was in Afghanistan, I was in a couple of black sites, which is in the book. It's, of course, as we know, it's In Obscura Part 1, because I can't write Part 2 until I let go of my experience. But I was in a couple of black sites, which made it through the review. I submitted the manuscript, of course, to the pre-publication review people. They took out a few small things, but because I did not identify the location of the black site, which is a sensitive thing, they let me write about debriefing terrorists and so on.
So, yeah, can you talk a little bit about that? Are you allowed to talk about interrogating terrorists?
I was not an interrogator. I was a debriefer. Sometimes there was an interrogator in the room. The interrogator is the first person, when the terrorist is caught in various, often nasty circumstances, the first person they see when the bag comes off over their head is the interrogator, who bonds with them and works with them and makes them realize, now you are a captive. You don't have any more control. When they've been through that process, they meet someone like me, who is a debriefer who, under very strict circumstances with cameras running and security guards in the room, I ask them questions. They have one wrist handcuffed to a ring in the floor. The other one is free to drink tea or eat a snack, which I have provided for them, and so on. And they answer questions, and we derived a huge amount of intelligence that way, despite what detractors of the program say.
They say that there was no intelligence gathered from the...
Torture doesn't work. Well, it wasn't torture. We don't torture them. Another mutual friend of ours, Christopher Hitchens, the late Hitchens, had himself waterboarded, famously, to see if it was torture.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
It took him a second round to decide that it was torture. And, of course, the Peters and Lees of the world reminded him, Christopher, if you asked for it to be done to you again, it probably isn't torture. This isn't like having your fingernails pulled out.
Yeah, right.
And let me really see if it's torture. So, the program had its detractors.
I'd forgotten about that. Why did Hitchens have to go back a second time to see if it was torture?
Because the first time, it left him mystified. I think if you're really screaming and never want it to happen to you again, then it might be torture. Or if you don't live to ask for it to be done to you again.
Right. Yeah, I guess if you have your nails on your left hand pulled out, you don't need to ask, well, I'm not sure if that was torture. Can you do it on the right hand too? Right.
My objection there, one final note on the enhanced interrogation techniques, is that the problem of having them revealed and condemned and so on and so forth, our focus was on the badness of doing that, which I disagree with that completely. But the terrorists learned our methods. They started waterboarding each other and doing all this stuff to each other as countermeasures. Because, okay, when the Americans capture you, this is what they're going to do to you. So thank you, Washington Post and everybody in Washington. Now you've given us their playbook. So they started doing what Hitchens did. We're going to go through all the measures, sleep deprivation and waterboarding and so on and so on. There are 13 of them. And they were prepared to be captured.
Right. ISIS, in fact, ISIS calls it the Hitchens Protocol, I think. No, of course not. Well, look, Peter, so this is volume one, and you say that in volume two. I don't want to rush through volume one because I want to, but I want to ask a little bit about what you were not able to get in volume one. So there was a pre-publication review that you have to go through. Is that just the CIA that does that, or are there other government agencies?
No, really? if you've held a clearance or continue to hold one, but you separate from government service, you are required. Not everybody does it. Some people blow it off. But you're required. When you sign a secrecy agreement, the first day you're hired, and you do sign a secrecy agreement, it's sort of like a non-disclosure agreement. You agree that you will not violate the secrecy rules, and that anything you publish will be reviewed for the use or the on the compromise of sensitive information. beyond, because I hold a clearance still at this moment. I cannot write part two, or rather I can write it. I just can't publish it yet. Because I am held to the standard, anyone still holding a clearance is held to the standard of a current overt employee, which means I can't criticize U.S. government policy or those of our allies. Because if our allies read it, someone like me criticizing them, they're going to say, oh, there's bias and judgment issues inside the U.S. government that they're not fair to us. So only after I separate can I get on, talk a little bit more about my career and get a little bit more opinionated about a country like Iran, which is currently absolutely mystifying so many of us about how deferential this administration is. And it killed me to not be as opinionated as I could be in part one, but just wait.
Well, let me ask you, in part one, were there people that you, were there government officials that you wanted to be critical of? Can you talk about that? Can you say who you were? Because in Iraq, I mean, you had lots of congressional delegations coming through and stuff. And then also when you were at Langley, you're working with, you know, you're working with lawmakers. So were there people who stuck out for you, people who are, deserve the criticism?
Yeah. There's a former ambassador. I refer to him as a bastard in the book. They let me say that because no one disagrees about that person. I won't end him on your show. In Iraq, the annoyance was, and I got away with a little bit of this, was Joe Biden came as a senator, Carl Levin of Michigan, Kurt Wellin of Pennsylvania, and they come there to ostensibly in their role on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee or something, and they're usually bipartisan when they visit. But they're there, it's a campaign visit. They go, if they're the Maryland or Delaware Army National Guard or Michigan National Guard is up in Mosul or Tikrit or somewhere, they want a photo op so they can go back and pretend they spent hours with our great servicemen and women. I gave them intelligence briefing in Baghdad. Biden was by far the worst. And he interrupts and laughs and winks and and he's a horrible listener. And he just can't wait to get his photo op and get out of the country. And I was a deputy chief there. The chief refused to talk to him because I really won't use the language that my superiors used about Biden. But the pre-publication review people did review redact some of my comments about Biden because they were negative. They were really negative. And he's our president.
Peter, I want to get to Iran, because this was one of the things that you worked on. You worked on Iran. There's Iranian proxies that you also worked on. I want to get to that in just 1 minute. We have to take a quick break because there's a whole bunch of people watching on YouTube. And if they're watching on YouTube, you have to make the jump with us to Epoch TV exclusively. Please make sure you make the jump because Peter Theroux, the author of the brand new book, In Obscura, Adventures in the World of Intelligence, is going to talk a little bit about what's going on in Iran, what's going on with American policy, what this administration is getting wrong, and the kind of dangers that this poses to the world. Peter, again, has seen this up close. Peter worked on hugely important files in the intelligence community. Great guy, great writer, amazing life. Make sure to make the jump. We'll see you in less than a minute. Imagine if you had to move to a different place to go to a different restaurant. There's only one restaurant in your community and you didn't like the food and they didn't care because that's the only show in town. This is what our system is based on.
The problem is that we assign millions of families to a one-size-fits-all system that by definition is never going to meet the needs of various families that just disagree about how they want to raise their children. If families have a say in their kids' education, the public schools shape up fast. 26 of 29 studies find positive effects of school choice competition on the outcomes in the public schools. It's a win-win solution.
What are the things between different private schools, charter schools, alternate public schools, and also homeschooling? I want to know what people are choosing. Corey DeAngelis, author of The Parent Revolution. Make sure you make the jump to Epoch TV. Welcome back to Words That Matter, a modern day book club. I'm your host, Lee Smith, and thank you for making the jump. We're continuing our conversation here with the great Peter Threw, author of the just published In Obscura Part 1, Adventures in the World of Intelligence. And one of the things we were talking about was different issues that Peter can't yet talk about because he still has security clearances. Peter, highly decorated intelligence officer with the CIA. One of the files that Peter worked on was the Iranian file. And I'm just gonna shoot right from the hip, Peter. Sorry, but were you responsible for killing Qasem Soleimani?
No, I have an alibi. I was right here, and that is okay. Sir, I did not kill Qasem Soleimani.
All right.
No. I was going to say his blood is not on my hands. I'm not going to go that far, but I didn't kill him.
Okay, but you worked on Qasem Soleimani. Of course, is the late commander of Iran's Quds Force, which is their expeditionary terror unit, the IRGC's expeditionary terror unit, and. Donald Trump targeted Qasem Soleimani, and I think that was I think the world is a better place, and I think that that was an excellent decision by Donald Trump. But Peter, you did work on the Iran file, and you were following different people. Can you, as a targeter at the agency? So can you talk about that a bit?
I can. I mean, it isn't a secret. Obviously, the U.S. government killed Soleimani. They had three Reapers in the air over Baghdad airport that blew up his motorcade. Actually, there were about eight targets: Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the notorious Iraqi, and a couple of generals. I mean, it was very, as they say, lucrative strike. But again, it's not a secret that the U.S. did it, and in order to have done it, there was a lot of preparation and targeting work done. It was, by the way, by degree, way overdue. He had a lot of American blood on his hands.
Yeah.
And what? Let me put it this way. I was pulled back from a field assignment because I had worked against Iranian proxies in the Levant, in the targeting discipline. And so I was pulled back to work on purely Iranian stuff, not their proxies. And it was surprisingly easy, and that was almost a letdown because you start to think with the resources we have, the collection, the operations, and the military capabilities of the U.S., this should all be easy. We shouldn't be talking to them in Oman and deferring to them on energy issues and all of those issues. It is easy to find them and punish them, including the ultimate punishment, like Soleimani. It's almost ridiculously easy. Our capabilities are so much better than theirs. It's ridiculous that we are not harsher against such a absolutely monstrous regime.
So what does it mean? This was, and you talked about this. What does a targeter do? And can you talk about the Iranian proxies that you were focused on?
What a targeter does, the discipline has, well, targets have been around for a while, but the discipline was defined and empowered much more at a certain point, 10, a dozen something years ago. You have headquarters analysts and you have field operators, case officers, and our own expeditionary forces. A targeter enables operations. They call it an analyst with a bias toward action. So that instead of a case officer under some kind of other government cover going to diplomatic receptions and trying to meet the Russian third secretary and find out if he's recruitable and, you're just randomly cold calling or doing stuff like that. A targeter finds the weakness in a regime or the weakness or the weak person or the person with vulnerabilities in a terrorist group and provides all of this information to the field operations officer saying, here is a guy, here is a Hezbollah or Hamas or Iraqi terrorist or Al-Qaeda person who is not a true believer. We have evidence they travel to a third country, they have a girlfriend, they gamble, they drink, they have a kid who needs medical help. Al-Qaeda or the Iranian regime or somebody, if they're there, kill the family member of this. You find somebody who is recruitable and you say, here's their phone number, here's their location, here's the way we understand their vulnerabilities or what they need, and you can go after them. So they hand operational opportunities to the real ops officers.
If you want to recruit them, what if you want to, what's the process you have to, what if it's different? What if you're targeting them for some other purpose, for instance, to kill them?
Exactly.
I mean, that is part of the job, right? That's part of targeting.
Again, that's no secret. That's no mystery. That's what happened to bin Laden. It's what happened to Soleimani. It's what happened to a lot of other bad people. But thank you for getting to that point, which I should have made first. You can target for access, for collection, to learn more about them from, say, the brother-in-law who hates them. If the brother-in-law is recruitable, but the primary target is not, target for recruitment, which can work nicely. If you're targeting for a lethal action, which is a very high bar in the government, our government requires presidential decision, a presidential finding, then instead of finding vulnerabilities for recruitment, vulnerabilities for where do they travel, car, bus, helicopter, commercial plane, what do their bodyguards look like? What's the deal with their drivers and who communicates? Do they use a cell phone and so on? Where can you physically find them and locate them? Now, Qasem Soleimani was a notoriously arrogant and reckless psychopath, and he was visiting. He was emboldened by the Obama nuclear deal with Tehran. He was strutting around Moscow and Syria and Lebanon and Iraq. And he was very findable, and he was very targetable. So it's no mystery how easily that was done.
As you were talking about, but I think you could follow Qasem Soleimani on different social media accounts. He's there taking selfies, meeting with his Quds Force troops in Syria or proxies in Iraq, and of course that's where he was. He was targeted at the Baghdad airport. That's where he was killed.
That's right. And maybe we should thank the former administration for the one part of the Iran deal, which is what it made people like him feel untouchable or kowtowing to us. They won't touch me. They don't dare touch me. He wrote a very famous letter to General Petraeus, sort of boasting and threatening him. And I'm sure any psychologist would have told you that this psychopath was extremely arrogant and getting more and more reckless. It did not take a terrible effort or risky effort to finally get rid of it.
Does the CIA spend time? I mean, you're talking about Soleimani as a psychopath. Does the agency spend time doing psychological profiles of people who come to their attention? Really? Okay.
Yes. No, there is a wonderful, a legendary psychologist, a woman who works there. And, psychologists are great people. They're kind of dual use because they study foreign leaders and terrorists and they write psychological profiles of them. But if you're an agency employee and you have a divorce, gambling problem, the extreme depression or some, you're at counterintelligence risk, that same psychologist will counsel you and be your therapist. They have medical degrees, they have PhDs, they have a top secret clearance there. They do all kinds of black compartmented work, including personnel. So they have great, the medical team there is in very much in the dark, but they're legendary.
Wow, what an amazing book that would be.
Part two of this.
All right, in part two of In Obscura. Let's come up to the present day, and both with what you're doing. So I don't know if you can talk about it. I want to talk about Iran, but also want to talk about your work. Can you say whether or not you're still doing work for the CIA? And I know you're officially out. You left when you officially retired. You got an important medal. You know, that what, and, but are you still doing, some work now? What would we call it, contracting work for the agency?
As I mentioned, I held on to my, clearance. What I do is, you can call it consulting or contract work. The term of art is in the national security space.
Ah, that's okay.
That's what it.
All right. So are you still focused on Iran? Because there's lots of people, like you and I have talked about this, and we've spoken about this with lots of our friends and stuff and like-minded people, and we see what's been happening in Gaza. We see what's happening now also in Lebanon as well. And I mean, look, the actor who's pulling the strings here is it's not a bunch of Palestinian psychopaths on the ground in Khan Yunis or something like that. It's the Iranians. So can you talk about that? What you're seeing in terms of Iran and also in terms of Biden administration policy, which appears certainly my case that it's a continuation of Obama policy toward Iran.
Yeah, and even worse. So, no, the short answer, no, I'm not doing anything for the U.S. government on Iran. But but it's on my mind a lot because as hideous as the mayhem and the atrocities have been in Israel and Gaza since early last October, it's a sideshow. This is an Iran-driven sideshow using all of their proxies. The Houthis wrecking the naval routes through the Red Sea. Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and Hezbollah, and the Iraqis, to destroy the Abraham Accords, to frighten Saudi Arabia, to try and destroy Israel, and to protect their nuclear program. This is an Iranian show, and it is nothing else. One of the ridiculous things about this administration is that they've tried to find a little wiggle room to say, well, we don't have evidence that Iran, directed, which woman to rape or which baby to behead. So we really can't say that Iran directed this. Well, that is nonsense. They know perfectly well the Iranians did this. It was planned. They have boasted about after the Israelis blew up the building between the Canadian embassy and the Iranian embassy in Damascus. They announced a general, I don't have his name in front of me, Mohammed something. They boasted he was no. The planner. It was planned right. With all of those groups together, like the Batman movie with with Penguin and Catwoman and the Joker all in the same room. It was done with all of those people. It's an Iranian plot. And unfortunately, day one of this administration, they emboldened Iran and the Houthis by removing them from the terrorism list and brought us to where we are today, kowtowing to Iran for energy policy. We don't want violence with Iran that would raise oil prices and gas prices before the election. And we're asking the Ukrainians, please don't hit Russian energy infrastructure, because we also threw away energy independence on day one of the administration by canceling the Keystone Pipeline. So the people who said that, former SecDef Gates, who said Biden is consistently wrong about every foreign policy issue, was an understatement. He's invented new ways to be wrong and undermine the security of this country. That's the kind of thing I
can't. Well, can you give us some insight and maybe can you give us some insight on what people are saying inside, inside the big building at Langley? Because, of course, a lot of the picture that we have, especially people on the right are saying, well, look, the CIA, they're all a bunch of woke lefties and they don't really care about America and they're serving some crazy agenda. But the way, thank God, the way that you portray it, and certainly you talk about it's a robust institution with problems, but nonetheless, it's filled with a lot of very serious patriots who love this country. So, can you give us some sort of insight on what they on what they're saying or what they're thinking about the Biden administration's policy toward Iran? I mean, this is a regime with lots of American blood on its hands, starting in 1982 in Beirut up to the present. So they killed the Iranian proxies have killed CIA officers, right? Starting with,
Buckley in Beirut, who was horribly tortured to death by Iranians, just like Higgins, Colonel Higgins in were murdered at, I think, the Sheikh Abdullah barracks, which by Iranian interrogators and torturers in the Bekaa Valley. Ali, one thing I would say about the agency is, you know, the saying that, you know, those who know don't talk and those who talk don't know. There is a lot of apples and oranges in the intelligence community. 90%+ of the people who work at headquarters and around the globe are fantastically focused people who don't get involved in anything partisan. No one knows what they do, and their spouses don't even know what they do. There are, let me put it tactfully this way, there's a reason I was brought back from an assignment to work on this specifically Iranian issue, because the person running the joint at that time lacked confidence. They had inherited a mindset from the Obama administration that we are, the whole national security structure was supporting the U.S. government's efforts toward a negotiation. I mean, we work for them, right? The intelligence agencies are part of the executive branch. The president says, I want this kind of collection and analyze this, and that's what they do. But a little bit of the mindset had survived that we should be a little bit easy on Iran. And the person under Trump who inherited the Iran program didn't see things that way. But I think Biden is utterly, utterly disastrous. Utterly disastrous here.
It's bad for America. It's bad for the region. I really think it's important, Peter, the way that you frame this. You say that as horrible as what's going on right now in the Eastern Mediterranean, there's a bigger story. And Americans who are just focused on Israel, and, you know, rightly as Americans, we say where our focus is here in the United States. That's our real problem, not Israel, etc. They need to understand that this is about the United States, because it's much bigger than just a grisly, demonic Palestinian terror group, Hamas, and others. It's about Iran, and it's about America. It's about American peace and prosperity. And Peter, the way that you really portray that in your book, and the way that you talk about it, and this is only one reason that I'm telling people they got to go out and they have to read In Obscura. They got to get a copy, and then they have to go read it, because it's just such a marvelous book. Again, how you go from, I won't put you on the spot. Well, I've already put you on the spot with Gina Davis, Susan Sarandon, and Qasem Soleimani, but people have to go out and they have to get the book. It's wide ranging. It's so much fun. It's a short book, and we're waiting for volume two. In the meantime, Peter, thank you for helping to keep our great country safe. Thank you for being a great writer and a great guy, and for being here with us this morning on Words That Matter. And thanks to all of you for watching Words That Matter. And we'll see you in our next episode.
What the FBI has now been all about is improving its brand. And the way that it does that is twofold. They look for headlines. They look for what's going on in the news, and they can see if they can insert themselves into that. Recently, there was a report that they had indicted 4 Russians for war crimes. Well, if you actually read the press statement, none of the 4 Russians is actually in custody. They're actually still in Russia. And 2 of them, they don't even know their names, but they get the headline. The second one is they make up the quality with quantity. They adopt local cases on a nearly daily basis. So you'll have a local law enforcement agency that develops and works and investigates an entire case start to finish. And then the FBI comes in and scoops it up and says, well, we can bring a federal charge here, and takes it, and then plasters that they have stopped some sort of fentanyl trafficker, when really it was a traffic stop from a uniformed police officer that pulled this person over. And then the FBI swept in at the very last minute, and of course dragged the case out for several years so they could hit their quotas, which is really the ultimate problem to me with the FBI, that they are incentivized through a quota system to bring the crime numbers up so they can justify their budget, whereas you would think law enforcement's goal is to bring crime down.
He is an FBI agent who's been suspended. He's an FBI whistleblower, author of True Blue, My Story, from Beat Cop to Suspended FBI Whistleblower. We're having a great conversation, very important conversation, with Steve Friend.